Okay, so once again, please don't forget the initial status of the meditation, and to make sure that you are at ease and relaxed, and everything is ideally even more relaxed than you normally are. The purpose of this part of the meditation is in a sense to allow the body to disappear, and the body to fade into the background, so it is no longer a problem. The more relaxed you can be, the more at ease you can be at the beginning of the meditation, the more powerful the mindfulness tends to arise.
Noch einmal, bitte vergesst nicht die einzelne Phase der Meditation immer noch mal zu wiederholen, dass ihr euch entspannt, dass ihr euch innerlich zurücklehnt und es euch bequem macht der Sinn und Zweck dieser einführenden Phase ist einfach, dass dem Körper erlaubt wird, zu verschwinden, in den Hintergrund zu treten, aus dem Bewusstsein zurückzutreten, sodass die Achtsamkeit sich umso besser entfalten kann. Im Idealfall sind wir jetzt auf jeden Fall entspannter, als wir das normalerweise sind.
and it is so crucial to use your perception in the right way as you do your meditation, and to look for the beauty of the present moment. And right now you can feel the sense of peace, the natural surroundings here, the natural peace that exists in this place. It is actually a very beautiful place, coming out of the city, coming into the countryside. As you feel the peace that is here, and as you feel that peace, it expands inside of you. The thinking mind dies down, all the problems in the world get left in the past, and you fill yourself up with the peacefulness instead. And as you do that, the mindfulness becomes established, and everything becomes far more beautiful as a result.
Es ist so wichtig, dass wir unsere Wahrnehmung auf die richtige Weise benutzen und dass wir die Schönheit in jedem Moment sehen können. Und gerade jetzt ist es gut, uns anzuschauen, wie friedlich dieser Ort ist, die Natur draußen, die Umgebung. Es ist ein schöner Platz hier. Und dieser Frieden, der natürlicherweise hier herrscht, kann sich in unser Inneres ausdehnen, in unseren Geist hineinziehen. Und wir können erleben, wenn wir aus der Stadt kommen, hier aufs Land, wie friedlich und ruhig das hier ist. Und das hilft uns, unsere Achtsamkeit jetzt zu errichten.
when you let that sense of peaceful clarity arise in your mind, this thing we call mindfulness, and that becomes strong enough, one of the things that you will be aware of all by itself is the presence of the breath. And when the breath arises in this way, that is the right time to allow your attention to rest on that breath. No willpower is required, no effort is necessary. All you do is allow the attention to rest on the breath itself. And then you and the breath just walk into stillness together. This ancient friend that you've been walking with for your whole life, and now take it into this beautiful state of meditation.
Und wenn sich dieser Friedenszustand im Geist einstellt und die Achtsamkeit stärker wird, dann wird sie irgendwann so stark, dass die eine Sache, die im Zentrum der Aufmerksamkeit ist, der Atem ist. Und das ist der Moment, wo wir einfach beim Atmen bleiben mit unserer Aufmerksamkeit. Wir brauchen dazu keine Willenskraft, es ist keine Anstrengung erforderlich, es ist ganz natürlich. Und einfach. Und wir folgen dem Atem und der Atem kann uns dann weiter in die Meditation hineintragen.
again becoming very close to the end of the meditation, and once again to spend a few moments just to reflect on the process and how the process actually works.
Wir kommen wieder zum Ende der Meditation. Wir nehmen uns nochmal ein bisschen Zeit, um zurückzublicken, wie der ganze Prozess gelaufen ist.
Okay, so let us start with the questions for tonight. So there's lots of heaps of questions here. Let's see how far we get. Okay, so the first one, which are these other remnants from last night? So see what happens. How important is it to call myself a Buddhist, or to declare Buddhism as my religion? Isn't it counterproductive to the idea of non-self and non-ego? And doesn't it make a difference between people like Buddhist and non-Buddhist, Catholic, etc., which is the cause of excluding people and not seeing and bringing us all as humans, not to differentiate each of us. We all have everything inside. Okay, so how important is it to call you a Buddhist? Not really all that important at all. You don't have to call yourself anything, really. That's perfectly fine. But the point is not so much what you call yourself. The point is more like, where is your heart? Yeah, what are you trying to do with your life? What is important to you? And this is what matters here. So when you say that you are a Buddhist, what you really mean is that you mean that you find your inspiration in the word of the Buddha, you find your inspiration in the suttas, in the Buddha as your teacher. That is essentially what it comes down to. And this is the idea of refuge that we have in Buddhism. Yeah, you take the three refuges, means that there's a place to go if you have a problem. You have somewhere you can kind of find answers to things in your life. Yeah, that is really all it means. So you don't have to call yourself a Buddhist if you don't want to. I don't think the Buddha called himself a Buddhist. Yeah? He probably was a Buddhist though, in one way, right? If the Buddha wasn't a Buddhist, we'd see it was trouble. He probably was. But it's not so much what we call ourselves, it's more how we practice. And of course the idea with Buddhism is that it's really a natural religion. It is about tapping into natural principles and using those natural principles to bring about happiness and bring about the end of suffering. That is really what it is about. Is it counterproductive to the idea of non-self and non-ego to call yourself a Buddhist? Not really. Because the whole Buddhist path is about, seeing through these things. Yeah, so the purpose is to move in that direction. If you call yourself human, it's just a classification of who you are. It doesn't mean that you get a lot of ego because you call yourself human. It's just kind of in contrast to animals. So you don't have to. Whatever. So I don't think there's a problem there. And sometimes we have to use some of these things in skillful ways to actually move forward on the path. So one of the interesting things the Buddha says in the suttas is that you have to have some craving to make an end of craving, you have to have some desire to make an end of desire, you have to have some conceit to go make an end of conceit. Yeah? In other words, you have to, if you don't have any desire at all, you're not going to sit down on the cushion and do the meditation practice. So there is a kind of for a while on the path, you have to have the kind of right kind of craving and the right kind of conceit, if you like it, to move you in the right direction. And eventually through that, you will overcome these things completely. So calling yourself a Buddha is not going to be a problem, but you don't have to. So either way, it's okay. Does it make a difference between... Sure, it makes a difference, but there is a difference, right? If you're a Catholic, you're a Catholic. If you are a Buddhist, there is a difference there in outlook, a difference in where we find our inspiration, sometimes a difference in views. So it's just really naming those differences, I suppose. I guess that's okay. Yeah. If you're born in Norway, they call you Norwegian. I don't know what that means. That's what they call me, and that's fine. You're born in Germany, you're called German. If you're born in the UK, you're called British or whatever. Yeah, so it's just these are just labels. They don't really matter all that much. But it's very convenient to have labels. Otherwise, it becomes very difficult to communicate if we don't have those labels. And you're right. Of course, these things can be used for excluding people. You're quite right. And if you use this label for exclusion purposes, then of course it becomes bad. So you know, as a Buddhist, you don't normally kind of look down upon Catholics or anyone for that matter, or atheists or Muslims or whatever. You look upon them quite, as you say, as people with feelings and with all of these kind of things. And you try to have compassion and kindness towards them. One of the points is that a label is only a temporary thing in Buddhism. Nothing is permanent. So if you call yourself a Buddhist, doesn't mean that you have always been a Buddhist and will always be a Buddhist. You happen to be a Buddhist in this life. In your last life, maybe you were a Muslim or a Christian. Or maybe you believed in Thor, right? I was probably believing Thor in my last life because I'm Norwegian. Yeah. So this is the thing. We're always changing and moving around, moving from one thing to something else. So when we compare, it's only a very relative thing, only lasting for a very short term. And by doing that, you don't get too conceited about it. You realize that next time around, the roles can be completely changed around. You are in the other position, they are in your position. Yeah, this life, you may be born in a wealthy country, and you may have a good education, all this kind of thing. Next time you're born in a poor country, you have no education whatsoever. So you don't look down upon people just because they haven't got an education. You don't look down upon them because they are poorer than you are, any of these kind of things. Because you realize that we've all been there, we've all done that. And if you look down upon those people for whatever reason, you're looking down upon yourself, because it's part of you as well at the same time. Yeah, this is the right kind of attitude. And then you never really feel conceited about anything. You never exclude anybody. You include everybody. And you try to have compassion and metta for everyone, whether they are human or non-humans or animals or ghosts, whether they are nasty people or kind people. Everyone, yeah. Wow, that is really the way to go. Okay, so... so I think that is... hopefully I have answered that question. Sorry. Okay, there you go. Yeah.
Thank you. Wie wichtig ist es, dass man sich selbst, dass ich mich selbst einen Buddhisten nenne, oder dass ich den Buddhismus, also meine Religion, bezeichne? Ist es nicht, führt es nicht in die falsche Richtung? Von der Idee des Nicht-Selbst und des Nicht-Ego weg und schaffe ich damit nicht eine Unterscheidung zwischen Menschen wie Buddhisten oder Nicht-Buddhisten oder Katholiken und so weiter und eine Unterscheidung, die zum Ausschluss von Menschen führen kann. Und dass man sie nicht als äh, dass man nicht alle als Menschen betrachtet, sondern dass wir nicht sehen, dass wir eigentlich alles in uns drin haben. So, die Antwort heißt, es ist eigentlich kein Problem oder es ist nicht wichtig, sich selbst als Buddhisten zu bezeichnen, aber wichtig ist eher, was man im Herzen hat, dass man zum Beispiel im Wort des Buddha seine Inspiration findet. Und das ist letzten Endes auch die Idee des Zufluchtnehmens. Die Idee, die mit dem Buddhismus verbunden ist, ist eigentlich eine Religion der Natur, der Naturgesetze, die uns helfen, aus dem Leiden herauszukommen. Und ob die Idee, ob die Bezeichnung als Buddhist der Idee des Nicht-Selbst entgegengeht, im Grunde genommen nicht, denn der ganze Pfad ist ja über das Nicht-Selbst und das ist kein Widerspruch. Man kann sich auch selbst als einen Menschen bezeichnen, das hat nichts mit dem Ego zu tun, das sind alles im Prinzip nur Namen, nur Bezeichnungen. Es ist wichtig, dass man diese Sachen auf eine auf die richtige Art verwendet, um auf den Pfad vorwärts zu gehen. Der Buddha sagt zum Beispiel, dass man ein bisschen Verlangen haben muss, um das Verlangen aufzulösen. Dass man ein bisschen Einbildung haben muss, um die Einbildung aufzulösen und so weiter. Der letzte Teil der Frage mit der Unterscheidung oder mit dem Ausschließen von eben zwischen oder Unterscheidung zwischen Buddhisten, Nicht-Buddhisten und Ausschließen von Menschen. Wenn man einen Unterschied benennt, zum Beispiel den Unterschied zwischen Buddhismus und Katholizismus, dann ist das eigentlich in Ordnung, das einfach so zu benennen. Ich bin in Norwegen geboren, ich bin deswegen Norweger, andere sind in Deutschland geboren und sind Deutsche oder sie sind in England geboren und sind Engländer. Und diese Etiketten oder Bezeichnungen, die sind einfach auch notwendig, da man sonst nicht miteinander kommunizieren könnte. Wenn man sie allerdings benutzt, um andere auszuschließen, dann ist das nicht die richtige Art der Benutzung und nicht die richtige Art, andere Menschen überhaupt zu betrachten. Und im Buddhismus muss man sich auch klar machen, dass solche Etiketten immer nur zeitweilig gültig sind und keine absolute Gültigkeit haben. Im letzten Leben ist vielleicht alles anders gewesen. Vielleicht habe ich in meinem letzten Leben an Thor geglaubt und bin deswegen jetzt Norweger. Und wichtig ist, dass man davon nicht irgendwie eingebildet wird. Und es kann auch sein, dass die andere Person und ich im letzten Leben oder auch vielleicht beim nächsten Mal genau die Positionen wechseln. Wenn ich jetzt eine gute Erziehung hatte, gute Ausbildung hatte und die andere Person hatte das nicht, kann es sein, dass es beim nächsten Mal umgekehrt wird. Alles, was wir in den anderen sehen, das haben wir alles selbst auch schon erlebt und getan. Und wenn wir aus diesem Grund auf jemanden herabschauen würden, würden wir im Prinzip eigentlich auf uns selbst herabschauen. Und es ist wichtig, dass wir alle einschließen, alle Menschen, und aber auch andere Lebewesen wie Tiere, Geister und so weiter.
Okay. So, the next one is, it says concerning chicken, is what it says. Oh, which one? Concerning chicken. So, okay, so the question is, could you please explain why it is said 8, 10 or 12 eggs? And this is the simile of the hen that has incubated her eggs and kind of sitting on them for a long time, so they're ready to kind of hatch. And if she has done her job properly, then the chicks will come out and they will be okay. And if she hasn't done her job properly, she has neglected the eggs, then regardless of whether she wants those chicks to hatch or not, that's not going to happen. That is that simile. Yeah. And why does it say 8, 10 or 12 eggs in that simile? Yeah. And the answer is that, I don't know actually why it says that. No idea. Absolutely no idea. That's the answer. Yeah.
Then there was any idea why it says 10, 8, 10 or 12 eggs in that simile? I've never even considered
that question before actually. It's a brand new question for me. It's extremely rare that I get new questions. I'm really excited about this question. Any ideas?
that what that might be? 8, 10 or 12, yeah. Mm. Like, I'll put that aside because very, very, this is extremely real. That is the question. I have no idea how to reply to that. That's it. Okay, so let's go on to the. Do you want to say anything about that? There's nothing much to say, right? Why not? Yeah. Why not? Yeah. Yeah, okay, maybe so that was kind of the standard boxes in those days. Yeah, maybe that's true. Maybe that was kind of the standard box size. Okay, now that is lateral thinking. Nothing to do with the Dhamma, just to do with the culture. Yeah, yeah, okay. Now that is very, you may be right. Yeah. Okay, so let's assume that for now. So let's go on to the next one then. In the 8 precepts, one of the undertakings is to abstain from singing and music. Singing mantras is a part of the yoga tradition. Why should one abstain from music? Also, what is the reason behind abstaining from the use of high and large seats and beds? Thank you. Okay, so then maybe we should have a singing retreat once. That would be really nice. You can sing some suttas or whatever. But the idea here is that you want to make the mind as peaceful as possible. Yeah, and if you do these kind of things, you tend to disturb the mind. Of course, it can be hard to see, but the more peaceful you become, the more obvious you become that singing, any kind of talking really, that's why we have noble silence, any kind of talking really will just tend to disturb the mind, stir it up, make you think more about things, and make it problematic to meditate as deeply as otherwise, hopefully, we can. So this is one reason. Another reason is that a lot of the singing and music is a kind of sensual pleasure. Yeah, so you're actually moving towards a different kind of happiness. You're moving towards the happiness of the senses rather than the happiness of the mind. So remember, a large part of this is to kind of withdraw the mind from the external happinesses and to turn it inwards instead. And as you do that, as you get that joy which is based on this meditation, based on being kind and being generous and all these kinds of things, you will realize that actually it's a much more powerful, much more beautiful happiness than the happiness that you get from these other things. And this is why we do that. We turn the mind in a different direction altogether. And it's really worthwhile. That's the point. It's really, really, really worthwhile. So you do it for that particular reason. So mantras are part of the yoga tradition? Yeah, okay. So, you know, sometimes you can sing mantras if you like it, but at the right time and the right place, yeah? Please don't do it in here when everybody's sitting here, because it might make you very unpopular, right, if you start singing mantras in here. But there is a time and place for that, so do it at the right time and right place. And one of the times that I think, you know, a bit of chanting and a bit of these kind of things is useful is, for example, if you come back home after a long day at work and you are very tired from doing whatever it is that you have been doing, then you need to calm down initially. And that is often a very good time to sing mantras or to listen to some Buddhist chanting and all of these kinds of things. Especially, I know many people from an Asian background who have grown up perhaps in an Asian country. They're used to hearing chanting from their tiny, tiny, tiny. Yeah, and you kind of be barely born and you start hearing Buddhist chanting. And you get so used to it and it's so soothing for you and you feel so happy when you hear that. For Westerners, it's a bit different because we're not used to it in the same way, so it doesn't have the same emotional impact if you're born perhaps in a Western country. But if you're born in an Asian country and you're used to hearing these things, it can be very powerful. So use these things in an appropriate way to make you feel relaxed, make you feel at ease. And if you use it in that way, it can be very powerful and very useful. It's all about the right thing at the right time. Yeah, this is kind of the purpose behind all of these things. So just know what you need to do at any particular time. And the purpose of abstaining from large and high seats and bed is basically the same thing. The idea is not to indulge too much in sleeping. That's the idea. So if you have a kind of big water bed, right? Oh, it's so comfortable. I can't get up in the morning and just kind of sleep all day. Especially if you come on a retreat, because when you come on a retreat like this, everything can seem so boring. So I might as well sleep 20 hours a day and I kind of, you know, eat the rest of the 4 hours and then something like that. So the idea is just to kind of to avoid too much indulgence. That's the idea. So that becomes the purpose behind these things.
Okay, die Frage betrifft in den 8 Ethikregeln ist die Rede, dass man keine Musik hören und nicht singen soll. In der Yoga-Tradition ist es aber Teil, oder gehört es dazu, dass man Mantras singt. Warum soll man keine Musik hören? Und auch weiterhin, was steckt dahinter, dass man keine hohen Sitze und Betten benutzen soll? Die Idee ist erstmal von der Musik, dass man den Geist eigentlich friedlich machen möchte. Und singen, genauso wie reden, das zerstreut den Geist, lenkt ihn ab. Und bei Musik ist es häufig auch so, dass es ein sinnlicher Genuss ist, Musik zu hören. Und es ist eine andere Art von Glück, die man sich damit verschafft, als das, was wir in der Meditation suchen. Und wenn man die Freude und das Glück, das auf der Meditation beruht, einmal kennengelernt hat, dann kann man sehen, dass es sehr viel stärker ist und sehr viel schöner als die anderen Arten von Glück, die durch die Sinnesorgane vermittelt werden. Mantras gehören zur Yoga-Tradition, das ist richtig, und es ist sicher auch sinnvoll, das hin und wieder zu singen, aber am richtigen Ort und zur richtigen Zeit. Zum Beispiel Gelegenheiten, wo Chanting sehr gut sein kann, ist, wenn man von der Arbeit nach Hause kommt und möchte gerne ein bisschen abschalten und sich ruhiger werden. In so einem Moment ist es gut, ein bisschen Chanting oder eben Mantras zu singen. Vor allem für Menschen, die in Asien aufgewachsen sind und die so etwas von Kindheit an häufig gehört haben und für die das dann auch einen hohen emotionalen Wert bedeutet. Das ist für uns Westler vielleicht ein bisschen anders. Wir verbinden damit weniger emotionale Qualitäten. Die hohen Sitze und Betten, dabei geht es darum, dass man nicht zu viel in den sinnlichen Genüssen schwelgt, dass man nicht zu viel eben schläft. Man könnte Lust bekommen, dann 20 Stunden am Tag zu schlafen, vor allem wenn hier nicht viel los ist in dem Retreat und die restlichen 4 Stunden mit Essen zu bringen. Es geht einfach darum, nicht zu viel in diese Richtung zu gehen.
Okay, so the next question here, I'm not sure if I really understand this question properly, to be honest. And, it says something like, does not to follow the Buddhist path mean to bring suffering not only to me, but I bring suffering or accept to make someone else to suffer as well? Who is responsible for the own suffering here? Thank you. So presumably you mean something about we should not only end our own suffering, but what about the suffering of others? Is that what you mean? And of course, the idea of the Buddhist path is precisely that. When you practice it properly, you're not only eliminating your own problems, you're also eliminating the problems of others at the same time. That is why, you know, the whole idea of sila, of morality on the Buddhist path, has a benefit not just for us, but obviously for others. When you're kind to others, it benefits others, and it benefits you. And I often like to say that an act that is spiritual, that is not worldly, but has a kind of spiritual effect, is an act which is both beneficial for others and for yourself at the same time. So when you have compassion for other people, you have kindness for them, they benefit, you benefit. When you are generous, other people obviously benefit, and you benefit from that generosity. When you meditate and become peaceful, it's good for you, but it's also good for others, because they reap the benefit of that peace that you have in your heart. Yeah. So all around, any act that is spiritual is one that is beneficial for everyone around, both for yourself and for others. Who is responsible for the own suffering? Who is responsible for the suffering? Well, in the end, we are each, in a sense, responsible for our own suffering. Yeah. Because it is, in a sense, we create that suffering through the way we think, through the way we act, through the way we relate to the world, through the way we have acted in the past, through our bad habits, all these kind of things. These are the things that create suffering in this world, both for us and also for other people at the same time. But it, that's in one sense of the word. But in another sense, you can argue no one is really responsible. Because of just cause and conditions coming together, we have been habituated, or we have been influenced to be the way we are now. And in one sense, when you look at yourself in that way, that I'm just kind of all these things coming together, you can say nobody is really responsible. It's just nature doing its thing. Nature is causing suffering for each one of us. And one day we come across a path called the Buddhist path, which says, well, actually, you can use nature in the right way. There are natural ways of getting out of the suffering. And if you use nature in the right way, by thinking in the right way, acting in the right way, you can end all these problems. Yeah, and that is what basically the Buddhist path is all about. So I hope that was what you were asking. I'm not entirely sure, but if it wasn't what you're asking, please try again tomorrow and we'll see what happens.
Gut, bei der nächsten Frage bin ich nicht ganz sicher, ob ich sie richtig verstanden habe. Keine Ahnung.
Yes, yeah.
Thank you. Bedeutet es, wenn man dem buddhistischen Pfad folgt, nicht folgt, dass man nicht nur, dass ich da nicht nur selber Leiden auf mich bringe, sondern dass ich auch andere Leiden mache oder dass ich akzeptiere, dass jemand anders deswegen auch leidet. Wer ist für das eigene Leiden verantwortlich? Es ist so, dass die Praxis des Pfades dazu führt, dass man nicht nur das eigene Leiden beendet, sondern auch das Leiden anderer. Wenn man zum Beispiel Lila praktiziert, dann ist es sowohl hilfreich für einen selbst als auch für andere. Wenn man Mitgefühl entwickelt, dann hat man selber was davon und die anderen auch. Genauso, wenn man großzügig ist. Oder wenn man durch Meditation kritisch wird, dann haben wir was davon und auch die anderen. Und eine richtige Praxis bedeutet immer, dass alle was davon haben, man selbst und die anderen. Wer ist verantwortlich für das eigene Leiden? Auf eine Art kann man sagen, dass jeder selber für sein eigenes Leiden verantwortlich ist, dass man durch die Handlungen, die in der Vergangenheit begangen hat, dass man damit die Bedingungen schafft, unter denen man jetzt lebt und so weiter. Aber in einer anderen, auf eine andere Art kann man auch sagen, niemand ist verantwortlich, denn alles ist ja nur Ursachen und Bedingungen, die zusammenkommen. Das ist die Natur, die praktisch ihre Arbeit hier macht. Und so kann man niemanden persönlich dafür verantwortlich machen. Und wenn man dann den buddhistischen Pfad begegnet, dann kann man lernen, die Natur auf die richtige Art zu nutzen, indem man mit dem Körper, der Sprache und dem Geist richtig handelt und damit diese ganzen Probleme zu beenden. Und das ist im Prinzip das, worum es auf dem Pfad geht.
Okay. So, the next one is as follows. Devante, concerning revulsion, how should this be developed in a way that does not create further conflict around innate desires? Although I grasp and perceive the significance of the implications of craving, an inner struggle is quite evident to me that feels rather like a tug of war. It is often strongest when on retreat. Okay. So, thank you. Okay, so maybe now you feel it. Are you feeling a tug of war right now? Can you feel some tension going on there? So the idea here, well, first of all, before I answer your question, the idea of innate desires. There is no such thing as innate desire. Yeah, this is kind of an important point. Desires are all conditioned, and they exist because those conditions are in place. So that is why it is possible to end desires. If they were innate, you couldn't end them, because it meant they were kind of part of you. They were part of your essence of who you are as a being. But they're not innate, and that's why we can end them. I think this is an important point. They're conditioned. They can be decreased. They can be increased. And ultimately, they can be ended as well. So, there is a tug of war between revulsion and non-innate desires. I'm just going to rephrase that slightly. So, the point here is that you don't really develop revulsion. Yeah, it's not something that you kind of set out to say, yeah, I'm going to develop revulsion. It sounds a bit weird if you think like that, right? I'm going to develop revulsion. So the idea is more that revulsion is a natural outcome of the practice. And the idea, and this is kind of the whole practice, if it's done in the right way, with the right attitude, without too much force, without kind of trying to do things which aren't natural or whatever, it tends to unfold in a natural way. And when it unfolds in a natural way, revulsion just happens. And when it happens, it feels completely natural. It doesn't feel like a tug of war at all. It feels, of course it has to be like this, because you've seen all the causes, everything falls into place in the right way. And because it falls into place in the right way, that is why it is so easy to do this. Yeah, it kind of happens just by itself, in a sense. And this, when the whole path happens like that, there's no sense of tension inside, desires going one way, and revulsion and all these kind of things going on a different way. So very often when you hear these teachings, the idea is not to force yourself to kind of believe in things in one way or believe in things in a different way. A lot of this is things that you have to reflect on. You have to think about them. Okay, the Buddha says this, and you think, okay, I can't relate it, I don't understand what he means. But if you don't understand what he means, you just put it aside for now, and maybe come back to it later on. Or you never come back to it, if you don't want to come back to it. And this is kind of the ideal way of doing that, especially if you are, consider yourself a Buddhist, you take these things seriously. It is important not to just throw them out completely, but just to allow them to sit there and kind of rest on them and to be with them and to allow to put them to one side and then come back to them later on when maybe you are more ripe or more interested or more you've come to that particular point in the path or what it is. And then I think you are dealing with these teachings in the right way. Yeah? So don't force yourself. If you force yourself, it's going to backfire. Yeah?
Die nächste Frage betrifft diese Sache mit dem abgestoßen sein. Soll man das auf eine Art und Weise entwickeln, die nicht für die Zukunft Konflikte mit den innewohnenden, mit dem innewohnenden Verlangen hervorruft. Und bevor er dann auf die Frage eingeht, sagt er, dieser Gedanke mit dem innewohnenden Verlangen, das Verlangen ist nicht innewohnend, sondern das Verlangen ist bedingt, und aus diesem Grund ist es auch möglich, das Verlangen zu beenden oder überhaupt zu verändern und letzten Endes aufzulösen. Die Frage geht weiter, obwohl ich die Bedeutung und die Implikationen des Verlangens verstehe, gibt es so einen inneren Kampf, der sich mehr so wie ein Kriegszustand anfühlt, und oft besonders stark, wenn ich in einem Krieg bin. Dieser Kriegszustand, der innere Kriegszustand zwischen dem Abgeschlossensein und dem Verlangen, ist es so, dass man das Abgeschlossensein nicht aktiv entwickelt, sondern dass es ein natürliches Ergebnis ist, wenn man richtig praktiziert. Es entfaltet sich auf natürliche Weise und wenn es dann da ist, dann fühlt es sich auch nicht wie ein Kampf oder wie ein Krieg an, sondern es fühlt sich ganz natürlich an. Und die Idee ist, dass man sich nicht zu etwas zwingen soll, man soll sich auch nicht dazu zwingen, Dinge auf eine bestimmte Art zu glauben. Und wenn man etwas nicht gleich versteht, so kann man es einfach mal zur Seite tun und später nochmal darauf zurückkommen. Oder eben auch nicht, wenn man nicht möchte. Die richtige Vorgehensweise ist dann auch, dass man die Sache nicht komplett verwirft, wenn man sie nicht versteht, sondern dass man sie einfach mal zur Seite stellt und später nochmal darauf zurückkommt. Das ist die richtige Art, auf diesem Ding umzugehen.
Okay, so the next one is how to do walking meditation. Is there a difference to sitting meditation then? And the answer is probably is a little bit different, because walking meditation is obviously a much coarser posture. Now, when you walk, you don't usually get quite as peaceful as you do in sitting meditation, but to a large extent, it is very, many of the things that you do are very similar when you do walking meditation as when you do sitting meditation. But what you really need to ask yourself, and this is kind of the important thing with meditation practice, is to ask yourself, what do I need now? What is the state of mind? What is the problem that I have to overcome at this particular time? Yeah, that is really the most important thing here. And sometimes you will find that after you've been sitting in here for an hour and a half or whatever, you need to do something else than watching your breath. Right? If you've been trying that for an hour and a half, usually meditation has a kind of natural curve to it. It kind of goes well, you become more peaceful, and you kind of stop being peaceful after a while. It's almost as if you come out of the meditation, it comes to a natural end in a sense. And then if you go out and you try to do more samatha meditation, calming yourself down, it may not work. So maybe then it's better to do something different. So you have to feel, one of the tricks of meditation is to learn what is required at any particular time. Yeah, so one of the things that I recommend you to do when you go walking meditation is just to enjoy it. Yeah, just to walk back and forth, just to enjoy the peace. Not to anything in particular. This was a Burmese monk, quite a famous Burmese monk who told me that many years ago. And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. And that's really nice, just walking back and forth, enjoying the peace. And after you've been sitting down, trying to watch your breath, or maybe even succeeding in watching your breath. But regardless, then it's quite nice to do something else. And just to walk back and forth, enjoying the peace. Wow, it's so nice to be here. And just feel the kind of the joy of being here, being in a nice place. And that is all you have to do. It means you relax, you are at ease. You don't become tense in any of these kind of things. Sometimes people get a bit tense when they try too much samatha meditation. They're not really able to relax fully. Some of you have already told me that. You sit down, you can't really relax properly. And if you can't do that, there's no point in trying to do more of the same when you go out walking meditation. Please do something else. Do something which relaxes you and makes you feel at ease. Yeah, just wandering around. You don't even have to do meditation at all. If you want to, you can just walk down the street or walk over to the forest. There's some nice ponds and a little river across the road over here. You can walk over there and just enjoy the peace of nature. Yeah. That will then, if you do that in the right way, it will enable you to come back to meditation later on and have more success in your meditation practice. So that is one way of doing walking meditation, just walking back and forth, not doing anything in particular, just enjoying whatever is here already. Another way, another thing you can do during walking meditation is to do some kind of contemplation. Yeah, because when you're walking, it's more natural, it's quite easy, the mind tends to be quite active while you're walking back and forth. So you can contemplate something. You can do a death contemplation, for example, and maybe we can do, I intend to do a death meditation later on. If you don't feel comfortable with that, you don't have to, certainly don't have to be here for that. In fact, I would recommend you not to be here if you feel uncomfortable with these things. But I want to do that later on, because some people find it very beneficial. So you can do that while you're walking as well. Yeah, just remind yourself that you're going to die. What does that feel like, the fact that you're going to die? You don't know when it's going to be. Yeah, it could be relatively soon. I sometimes think about myself, I think, well, you know, I may never leave this retreat center. Yeah, I better enjoy it, otherwise I'm waiting. Yeah, so this is a kind of thought, and once you think like that, you kind of clear away so much of the nonsense in life, so much of the petty little things, so much of that ill will, stupid desires, and all of these kind of things. You clear it out, and it brings you back into the present moment. So this is the power of some of these contemplations. The, you know, death contemplation is really just one aspect of impermanence contemplation, so you can also reflect on impermanence more broadly, if you like. Any of these kind of things are very useful. And I will talk more about these kind of contemplations as we go through this retreat. Another thing you can do while you are walking back and forth is just to watch your mind. Yeah, I mean, one of the important things if you're going to do the Buddhist practice properly is to know yourself really well, to know what your problems are. what are my many defilements? What are the problems I have to deal with? And sometimes you will know that there are certain people, for example, in your life that you find difficult. You don't know how to deal with them. So this now is the opportunity to overcome those particular people that are difficult in your life. How can you have a sense of compassion for these difficult people? How can you see the good qualities in them? Yeah. How can you turn your mind around that problem actually disappears? And this you can do during your walking meditation practice. And this is very powerful in clearing up problems that are bound to block your ability to go deeper in meditation. Yeah, so this is another thing you can do. And that is almost like meta-meditation, because you're learning to overcome any negative thoughts you have about somebody. And then the last thing you can do, if you feel that you want to do samatha or peace meditation, you can just walk back and forth, and you can watch the feeling in your feet as you walk back and forth. Yeah, step, feel, feel, feel. And then turn around after about 20 or 30 steps and go back again. And keep on doing that. And that can be the samatha meditation you can do when you walk. When you do walking meditation, I would recommend you to walk at a normal pace. Don't try to force yourself to walk very slowly or anything like that. Because if you walk very slowly, again, you are constraining your mind, putting pressure on your mind to do things which isn't quite natural. So you're actually forcing yourself rather than being natural about what is going on. You use too much force, you're going to tire yourself out and you're not going to really enjoy what is going on. So I would recommend you to walk naturally. This is one of the things I was always taught by Ajahn Brahm, and I think it is very, very good advice. Because then, when you become peaceful, it's a very natural kind of peace, which is energetic, which doesn't have any tiredness to it, and it's naturally bright and beautiful. Okay, so that is a few hints for you for walking meditation. So good luck and see how you go with that. Oops. Yep.
Ja, wie praktiziert man die Gehmeditation und gibt es einen Unterschied zur Sitzmeditation? Ja, es gibt einen Unterschied. Das Gehen ist eine etwas gröbere Körperhaltung und man wird nicht ganz so friedlich dabei wie bei der Sitzmeditation. Und wichtig ist, dass man sich selber fragt, was brauche ich jetzt? Wenn man eine lange Zeit, zum Beispiel anderthalb Stunden gesessen hat, dann kann es nötig sein, dass man auch mal etwas anderes tut. Und wenn man mehr Samatha-Meditation macht, dann kann es sein, dass es nicht so richtig funktioniert und dass man mal was anderes machen soll. Ich selbst nutze die Gehmeditation oft in der Art, dass ich einfach genieße, vorwärts und rückwärts auf und ab zu gehen. Und dass ich einfach dabei den Frieden genieße, dass ich mich entspanne, mich wohlfühle, dass man dabei innere Spannungen auflösen kann. Wenn man zum Beispiel merkt, ich setze mich hin und ich kann mich dabei nicht richtig entspannen, dann ist es gut, was anderes zu machen und einfach mal auf diese Art Gehmeditation zu praktizieren. Oder man macht einfach einen Spaziergang durch den Wald, und genießt einfach nur so den Frieden der Natur. Und dann ist es möglich, dass man später beim Sitzen nochmal mehr Erfolg hat. Eine andere Art, Gehmeditation zu praktizieren, ist, dass man es zur Kontemplation nutzt. Zum Beispiel Kontemplation über den Tod. Ich werde später auch noch eine Meditation anleiten über den Tod hier, und wer aber das nicht gerne möchte, dem wird geraten, dann auch nicht teilzunehmen. Es kann gut sein, über den Tod nachzudenken und sich auch bewusst zu machen, dass er vielleicht schon bald eintritt. Es könnte sein, dass ich gar nicht mehr aus diesem Retreat-Zentrum hier weggehe, und dann tue ich ja besser dran, dass ich es hier genieße. Die Todesbetrachtung ist einfach nur ein anderer Aspekt der Betrachtung der Vergänglichkeit. Eine weitere Art, die Gehmeditation zu nutzen, besteht darin, dass man seinen eigenen Geist beobachtet und besser kennenlernt. Dass man seine eigenen Probleme besser kennenlernt. Es ist wichtig, dass man sich selber gut kennt. manchmal kann es zum Beispiel sein, dass eine bestimmte Art von Leuten einem schwierig vorkommen und dass man nicht richtig weiß, wie man damit umgehen soll. Und das kann zum Beispiel etwas sein, was man in der Gehmeditation dann gut nutzen kann, dass man sich überlegt, wie kann ich mit solchen Personen am besten umgehen, wie kann ich diese Probleme für mich klären, wie kann ich zum Beispiel Mitgefühl entwickeln anstatt Ärger und so weiter. Und dann wird die Meditation sowas ähnliches wie Metta-Meditation. Und noch eine weitere Art der Gehmeditation ist, dass man es als Samatha-Meditation nutzt. Und das heißt, man beobachtet einfach das Gefühl in den Füßen, wenn ich einen Schritt mache und den nächsten Schritt, wie fühlt sich das an? Und das ist dann eben die Samatha-Meditation. Was ich auf jeden Fall empfehle für die Gehmeditation, ist, dass man ein normales Gehtempo wählt und sich nicht zwingt, besonders langsam zu gehen. Das ist wieder eine andere Art, sich selber zu zwingen und den natürlichen Fluss da rauszunehmen und viel besser auch im normalen Tempo zu gehen.
Okay, so the next one. In your talk on the Singsapai Grove, you expressed another word for revulsion, which was aversion. Any talks I have listened to so far say aversion is avoidance, not wanting to deal with something, and so the suffering continues. According to this text, revulsion is beneficial. Have I understood you correctly? Thank you. Okay, so remember these are just words, right? So it depends on how we use these words. We can be used in different ways. And when you use aversion, can be used in a negative sense, in the sense that you are turning away, you don't want to deal with it. Or it can be used as a defilement of the mind, when you when you actually get almost like angry and upset and these kind of things. So it really depends on how you use it. But aversion, the way I was using it here, is just in the sense of a turning away of the mind from something, where it's just too much, it becomes unbearable. It's like revulsion, or you are repelled by something, and you're pushed away from that. Yeah, so it was just a particular way of using these words. And so you have to see the context to really know whether a word is, how it is used, to be able to say whether it is appropriate or inappropriate and these kind of things. So in this case, it is just the idea that the mind turns away from suffering. That's really all it means in this particular context. It doesn't imply any kind of avoidance in the wrong way or any kind of ill will or any kind of defilement or anything like that. Okay.
In dem Vortrag über den Sapa-Wald, da kam das Wort Revulsion, also abgestoßen sein, vor. Und ein anderer Ausdruck dafür war die Aversion, der dafür benutzt wurde. Und in anderen Vorträgen, die ich gehört habe, da wurde gesagt, dass Aversion etwas mit Vermeiden zu tun hätte, dass man sich nicht mit einer Sache beschäftigen will und dass man damit das Leiden nur fortsetzt. Und so wie es in diesem Vortrag aber ausgedrückt wurde, schien es mir, dass das Abgestoßensein etwas Positives wäre, und habe ich das jetzt richtig verstanden? Okay, das sind alles Worte, und Worte können auf unterschiedliche Art und in unterschiedlicher Bedeutung benutzt werden. Und Aversion in diesem Zusammenhang bedeutet einfach, dass man sich von etwas abwendet. Man muss die Sachen immer im Zusammenhang sehen, und in diesem Zusammenhang heißt es einfach nur, der Geist
when it is from lying up. Okay, so the next question is, dear Brother Ajahn, could you please explain the body witness, the third of the seven types of persons? Thank you. Okay, so the body witness, this is a kaya sakhi in Pali, and the idea of the body witness is basically a person who is an Arya, who is a noble one, but apart, in addition to being a noble one, they also have experience very high attainments of samadhi, yeah? So it means that you have attained some of the immaterial attainments specifically, yeah? And what is interesting about this particular type of person is the actual name that is used for this person. Because kaya, it normally means the body, yeah? So you are called the body witness, but actually what you have witnessed is actually the immaterial attainment. So how can you be said to experience the what does that have to do with the body? And it has nothing to do with the body at all, of course, nothing to do with the physical body. What it means is somebody who has a direct experience of something. The idea of kaya, again, means a direct experience of something. This is what is interesting, the most interesting part of this idea of the kaya saki is the use of the word kaya. And it alerts us to the fact that you have to be careful with some of these words because they are used very broadly in the sutta sometimes. Here it means like a direct experience or an immediate witness, if you like, of these particular attainments.
Die Frage betrifft die Erklärung, was ein Körperzeuge ist. Das ist die dritte von sieben Arten von Personen, die in den Lehrreden aufgezählt werden. Ein Körperzeuge ist auf jeden Fall ein Arya, ein Edler, der bestimmte sehr hohe Zustände von Samadhi erfahren hat, und zwar die formlosen Zustände. Und das Interessante ist, dass auf der einen Seite das Wort Körper benutzt wird und auf der anderen Seite die formlosen oder immateriellen Zustände. Und die Bedeutung von Körper in diesem Zusammenhang ist einfach eine direkte Erfahrung. Das heißt, diese immateriellen Zustände werden direkt erfahren. Und man muss aufpassen, was in den Pali-Sutras, wie die Worte da manchmal benutzt werden. Und man kann nicht immer in dem Sinn verstehen, wie sie auf den ersten Blick erscheinen.
Okay. Okay, next one is as follows. The Venerable Adam, how is the Aganya Sutta to be understood? As it is on mythology spoken by the Buddha. Thank you. Yes, the Aganya Sutta is found in the Digha Nikaya. It's Sutta number 27 on the Digha Nikaya. And it is quite a well-known sutta precisely because it is a mythology, as you rightly put it. And I think it should be understood as mythology. I think the Buddha is deliberately telling a story that is legendary and mythological to make a point of Dhamma. Yeah? That is what it really refers to here. And the person who should really ask this kind of question is not me, but you should ask Ajahn Sujato, Bhante Sujato. He is the master of mythology. He loves mythology and this kind of stuff. So maybe next time he comes here, are you going to invite him next year? Where is he going to come back next time?
I have advised him, but he doesn't want to make any commitments until he's finished this time.
Okay, fair enough, you can kind of understand that. So anyway, the next time he comes, right? Maybe it will be next life, but we'll see what happens. So the meaning of this mythology, the nice thing about mythology and legend is that you can read many meanings into it, right? It is a story and often it will have many sides to it and many aspects of this mythology. But I think one of the meanings of the Ganga Sutta is a kind of to show the tendency of the human mind. And you see the tendency that for those of you who know the sutta, it's the kind of how human, or not human beings, but how beings who start off with being very high, being very light, being very beautiful, being translucent and luminous and all these kind of things, gradually they become coarser and coarser and coarser and coarser, right? Going downhill. And I think the idea here is to show us this is actually the natural tendency of human beings, to all of us. We have a tendency to become coarser. Unless we actually stand back and we say, I don't want to go there, I want to keep a moral conduct, I want to restrain some of these desires. If you don't restrain anything, if you have no sense of morality or anything like that, the natural tendency is for things to get worse. So I think that is an important message from that sutta. And it just shows us that we have to be very careful about how we live our lives. Otherwise, the natural tendency is always in the wrong direction. Why is that the natural tendency? Because craving is never satisfied. because craving is never satisfied, we will move towards more and more kind of wild expressions of these cravings in the hope of ultimately satisfying these things. And there is no end to that. That's why it moves kind of in the wrong direction, eventually breaking your precepts in very bad ways, etc. So that is one way of understanding the Aganya Sutta. And I think there are many other ways too. I have to have a look at it and kind of remind myself of all the details to be able to bring it up, to be honest. But maybe that's good enough for now. Huh?
Die Frage ist, wie ist das Aganya Sutta zu verstehen? Geht um Mythologie und es ist vom Buddha selbst gesprochen. Aganya Sutta ist in Diga Nikaya zu finden, die Nummer 24, und es ist ein sehr bekanntes Sutta und es ist tatsächlich ein mythologisches Sutta und sollte auch als Mythologie verstanden werden. Und eigentlich sollte man diese Frage Bhagavad-Sutta stellen, der Experte für Mythologie ist. Und Ayurveda hat ihn auch eingeladen, aber er wird sich nicht festlegen, solange er mit seiner Übersetzungsarbeit nicht fertig ist. Wer weiß. Man kann dieses Sutra auf verschiedene Art und Weise verstehen und verschiedene Bedeutungen darin sehen. Und eine Möglichkeit ist, dass es einfach zeigt, welche Neigung der menschliche Geist oder der Geist der Lebewesen überhaupt hat. Wie zum Beispiel Lebewesen, die am Anfang sehr leicht und sehr schön und leuchtend sind, ganz allmählich gröber und gröber werden. Und diese natürliche Tendenz, die steckt in uns allen drin, solange wir nicht einen Schritt zurücktreten und beschließen, jetzt Zurückhaltung zu praktizieren. Und warum ist das so, dass wir diese natürliche Tendenz haben? Das ist deshalb so, weil das Verlangen niemals befriedigt werden kann. Und ein unbefriedigtes Verlangen hat die Tendenz, immer wildere Ausdrucksformen zu finden. Und am Ende übertreten wir alle Ethikregeln, die wir uns vorgenommen haben und so weiter. Das ist einfach diese Tendenz, die in diesem Zustand gezeigt wird. Und es gibt sicher noch andere Arten, wie man das betrachten kann, aber ich habe jetzt auch nicht alle Einzelheiten so im Kopf und das soll für heute mal genügen.
Okay, so next question here is it okay to use mantra for meditation? Thank you. Yes, it is okay. You can use mantras for meditation. Different kind of mantras, people use different things depending on all kind of things. In Thailand, in the Thai forest tradition, very common to use Buddha as the mantra. Breathe in Buddha, breathe out Do, right? Buddha, Buddha, etc. Yeah, that is one, but you don't have to use that one. You use that one because it's meaningful for you. You can do something else, like peace, or, breathe in peace, breathe out, letting go, or something like that. Anything which is meaningful for you, anything which kind of points you in the right direction, then kind of enables your meditation as a consequence, is very useful to use. The mantra is useful often at the beginning of meditation, when you start out, and then when the meditation starts to become peaceful, you can let go of the mantra, just watch your breath, just enjoy the happiness of the present moment or whatever it is. So it's good to kind of get you started a little bit. And then it comes a point when you let go of that and you move on to a deeper state of meditation. That is one way of doing it. It's not actually mentioned anywhere in the suttas. So it is certainly not required, and I think if I were to choose, I would always choose the meditation suggested by the Buddha, and that I would say is just, watch the breath basically, do anapanasati practice. According to the suttas, anapanasati takes you all the way from the beginning of the path all the way to the end. It's really all you have to do, and you would fulfill everything, all the factors of the path, just by watching your breath. It's really simple, right? It's really neat. Just watching the breath is all you have to do. It's quite handy. Sometimes the path seems so complicated, so it's really nice to get a simple formula. This is all you have to do. Watch your breath, and you're in business as a consequence. Okay.
Ist es in Ordnung für die Meditation, ein Mantra zu benutzen? Ja, das ist in Ordnung, das zu benutzen. In der thailändischen Waldtradition wird zum Beispiel das Mantra Bhutto benutzt. Und wenn einem das passend erscheint und bedeutungsvoll erscheint, dann kann man das benutzen. Oder man kann was anderes benutzen, wenn einem das eher passend erscheint, zum Beispiel Frieden beim Einatmen und Loslassen beim Ausatmen. Oder was immer einem selber zusagt und was in die richtige Richtung zeigt. Und Mantras sind vor allem am Anfang der Meditation geeignet und dann später, wenn der Geist ein bisschen stabiler wird, dann kann man das loslassen. Sie sind nicht notwendig und sie werden auch vom Buddha nicht erwähnt. Und ich persönlich ziehe vor, so zu meditieren, wie der Buddha das gelehrt hat und einfach nur den Atem zu betrachten und das ist, da steckt alles drin, was man braucht.
Okay, let's do a couple of more questions because there are so many, so we have to make some headway with these questions. So let's do a couple more just to see what happens. So, dear Ajahn, regarding associating with good people, does the internet count? Can you associate with the internet? And I guess it is like a second best, perhaps. It's not kind of the ideal way because you can't interact so much over the internet. It's more like a one-way street, but it certainly is good. Just like reading the suttas, in the Nikayas is great. In the same way, hearing good teachings over the internet is also useful, of course. So I would say it counts, at least to some extent, that it counts. I chose Buddhism as because of the BSWA presence on the internet, I chose Buddhism as my way of life. Wow, that's really, really cool, actually, really. That's very nice to hear those kind of things because it means it works. Yeah, you get Adam Brahm on there every week telling a few jokes, a few nice stories, and a little bit of kind of spirituality in between. You know the ancient saying, right? I'm not sure if you know about this one. The ancient Tibetan saying, which is suitable in Tibetan monastery. Saying is that you first you make somebody laugh, and when the mouth is agape, you chuck in the pill of wisdom. That is apparently it was said by some kind of Tibetan master here. That's Ajahn Brahm's idea, right? You can tell from how he teaches the Dhamma at BSWA here. But going to Australia or Thailand to meet extraordinary people is too far and too expensive for some of us. Can you please suggest some people in North America or Europe that would be beneficial to meet? Much obliged. Okay. Can I suggest some people that would be beneficial to meet? It's very tricky to suggest particular individuals because I don't know many of these people, right? You hear about some, and of course I have a lot of respect for people like Venerable Analia, who is right here in Germany. I don't know who has written this question. And I have a lot of respect for him, but I don't know him all that well. It's very difficult for me to say anything very specific about him. I have a lot of respect for people like Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, who has done such a wonderful translation of the suttas. So all of these monks are probably really worthwhile visiting. But in the end, you have to try out for yourself. You have to visit some of these people and see if it feels good, if it is something positive or not for you. And it's really up to you to kind of make those kind of decisions. But at the very least, you can hang out with the Buddha, right? That is the most important thing. You make that your main hangout, and then you are hopefully going the right direction here.
Okay. Die Frage betrifft das Zusammensein mit guten Menschen. Zählt das Internet? Ja, das Internet zählt. Das ist sozusagen der zweitbeste Weg, wenn ein direktes Treffen nicht möglich ist und man hat nicht so viel Austausch, es ist mehr so eine Einbahnstraße, aber es zählt. Und dann geht die Frage weiter. Die buddhistische Gesellschaft West Australiens ist der Grund, oder und ihre Internetpräsenz ist der Grund, warum ich den Buddhismus als meinen Lebensweg gewählt habe. Aber nach Australien oder nach Thailand zu gehen, um besondere Menschen zu treffen, ist für mich zu weit weg und zu teuer. Oder für einige von uns zu weit weg und zu teuer. Und welche Menschen gibt es in Nordamerika oder in Europa, die man treffen könnte, was einen positiven Effekt haben könnte. Ja, wunderbar, wenn das mit der buddhistischen Gesellschaft aus Australien so gut geklappt hat. Und die vielen Vorträge von anderen Farben sind wunderbar zu hören. Und es gibt ein tibetisches Sprichwort, das gut zu dem tibetischen Zentrum passt, in dem wir uns jetzt befinden. Das sagt, macht die Menschen lachen, und wenn sie den Mund offen haben, dann wirft die Pille der Weisheit hinein. Und das ist Ajahn Brahms Strategie, wie er vorgeht. Und in Amerika und Europa gibt es zum Beispiel den ehrwürdigen Ananang, der hier in Deutschland lebt, für den ich viel Respekt habe, aber den ich auch nicht sehr gut jetzt persönlich kenne. Und mit Vico Bodhi in Amerika ist es genauso. Und am Ende ist es so, dass jeder selbst herausfinden muss, mit wem er gut zurechtkommt, wo er sich inspiriert fühlt und was die richtige Person für jeden Einzelnen ist. Und trifft den Buddha, nicht zu vergessen.
Okay. So, just a quick, couple of quick ones at the very end. Dear Ajahn, can you do a quick summary at the end of the daily lectures? I don't really consider them lectures, but anyway. Okay, but anyway, so I know what you mean. In plain English, please. Thank you kindly. I thought I was speaking plain English. Wow, that's a letdown. I've got to make it more plain. Okay, sure, of course. I'm happy to do that, so please remind me tomorrow. I'll do like a 1 minute summary at the very end. Very, very brief one there. So, good idea, actually, because sometimes when you summarize things, things become more clear. So I put this here for reminding me. Yeah? Okay, good. So, then one last question for tonight. Dibante, how to do walking meditation while there are ants on the path? Thank you for the answer. Okay, well, the ants on the path. Okay, so if there are ants on the path, it's, you know, obviously, you can't be too kind of careless, right? Oh, these ants, they're in the way, they deserve to die, right? That is the wrong attitude. If you have that kind of attitude, there's no way your meditation is going to go anywhere. So you have to be, either you can be incredibly mindful and walk between the ants, right? That's one possibility. Or you can find somewhere else to walk. That's really the answer. That's a fairly obvious, really. Yeah, so I hope you're happy with that, otherwise I don't know what to say, so you just try it out.
Wie kann ich die Meditation praktizieren, wenn Ameisen auf dem Weg sind? Die falsche Einstellung wäre, sie verdienen es zu sterben, diese Ameisen. Damit wird man sicherlich keinen Frieden finden. Die nächste Möglichkeit wäre, dass man so unglaublich achtsam ist, dass man zwischen die Ameisen tritt. Und die dritte Möglichkeit ist, man geht woanders.
Okay. Okay, great. Okay, that's all for tonight. So please have a nice sleep, and then we'll see you again tomorrow morning. And of course, let's do the Arahant Samasana again.
Arahant Samasambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savakasango Sangang Namah.